This is NPR's Movie Podcast. Coming up, we have a conversation with Israeli director Ari Folman about his movie Waltz with Bashir. Actor Frank Langella stops by our studios to talk about playing President Nixon in the movie Frost Nixon. And to discuss Valkyrie, Tom Cruise and Bryan Singer chat with NPR Scott Simon. But first, a review of Revolutionary Road.
Just over a decade ago, Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio played a couple who fell in love in the movie Titanic. Now they are reunited in a film called Revolutionary Road, and Bob Mondello says this time they are playing a couple that is titanically unhappy.
When they met, April and Frank wanted it all.
You've been to Paris?
I've never really been anywhere.
Well, maybe I'll take you with me then, huh? I'm going back the first chance I get, I tell you. People are alive there, not like here.
It was the 1950s. Frank had dreams but no job. April pictured her life as an actress. The future was theirs.
I want to feel things. Really feel them.
I think you're the most interesting person I've ever met.
Then Frank got a job, April got pregnant, and Paris and feeling things slid to the background. With dreams deferred, they started talking to realtors.
As you can see, Crawford Road is mostly these little cinder blocky, pickup trucky places. Plumbers, carpenters, little local people of that sort. But eventually it leads up to Revolutionary Road, which is much nicer. Now the place I want to show you is a sweet little house, a sweet little setting. Simple, clean lines, good lawns, marvelous for children. It's just around this next curve.
Buy the house, go to work, take out the garbage, have an affair. Slowly they mortgage their dreams. Their marriage turns sour. They end up at each other's throats, and then things really go wrong. Now, I've been telling the story chronologically, but the movie and the novel it's based on don't. Revolutionary Road jumps around in time, with the result that you don't get to know April and Frank before you see them at each other's throats. Director Sam Mendes makes 50s suburbia a persuasively suffocating place. He did the same for 90s suburbia in American Beauty, remember? But these characters are so selfish and self-centered, and the screenplay is so calculated about bringing them to their knees that the movie feels sort of hermetically sealed. Was conformity in the 1950s really that straitjacketing, you wonder? And just as you're wondering, an expert in straitjackets shows up, the real estate agent's son, fresh from the mental hospital, which makes him the ultimate 50s nonconformist, someone who says what he means. It's like a challenge amid all the small talk, so when he asks about Frank's job, Frank also says what he means.
Actually, it's sort of a stupid job, really. There's nothing interesting about it at all.
What do you do it for, then?
Maybe Frank doesn't like being questioned.
Oh, okay. I know. It's none of my business.
And besides, I know the answer. You want to play house, you got to have a job. You want to play very nice house, very sweet house, then you've got to have a job you don't like. Anyone comes along and says, what do you do it for? He's probably on a four-hour pass from the state funny farm. All agreed?
Michael Shannon plays this guy and pretty effectively steals the scenes he's in from Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio, but they don't have any trouble reclaiming the story as it turns darker, and it gets really dark by the final fade. The Richard Yates novel, Revolutionary Road, written back in 1961 when critiques of the suburbs were themselves revolutionary, is by all accounts devastating, but the characters' problems seem sort of their own making in the movie, which leaves you with a few questions. Were Frank and April really as special as they think they are? Were they ever likely to set out on a road that could be called revolutionary? And if not, why is their misery, however expertly brought to cinematic life, worth 2 hours of our time? I'm Bob Mondello.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Israeli filmmaker Ari Folman has made a remarkable documentary called Waltz with Bashir. It begins with a nightmare. A pack of dogs chase an Israeli man in his 40s. Like Folman, the man is a veteran of Israel's 1982 invasion of Lebanon, of the siege of Beirut. The man's memory of that campaign is haunted. In the film, Folman's memory is clouded and full of holes. Waltz with Bashir documents Folman's efforts to fill in the holes, to piece together his unit's role in the massacre of Palestinians at the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps. Israel's Lebanese Christian allies did the killing, but the Israeli army controlled Beirut, and soldiers like Folman were at best unwitting accomplices. This is not a heroic view of the Israeli army. Waltz with Bashir is about war and memory, and here's the most stunning thing about it. It's animated, beautifully. Folman shot the movie, and then he had illustrators reduce it or enhance it to drawings.
I did it because animation gave me the total freedom to go from one dimension to another, from reality to dreams, to subconscious issues, to hallucinations, to drug influences, to war, which is probably the most surreal thing on Earth, at least that I have experienced. And I mean, the stream of events in the film, to go from one dimension to another, the only way was to draw it.
I heard the art director of Waltz with Bashir, your colleague, say that animation, one advantage of animation, was also to appeal to young audiences.
Yeah, it was. For me, it was very essential to bring young audience to the theaters to watch the film, because I thought that if this film could influence even one teenager taking a decision not to go to war, doesn't matter where, I did my job. Mm-hmm. No, I earned it. And this is a general statement that appeals to this film, but it can appeal to any other war. That, I mean, all wars are useless, a very useless idea, and sometimes in films we tend to glorify them by making all those great characters, and that they show you that it's all about bravery and brotherhood of man, and I don't believe in that.
You don't believe in that?
No, not at all.
One thing you relate very clearly of the experience of being at war in Lebanon in 1982 is the sense of fear, the fear that people felt.
It's more than fear. It's just you're very young and you're totally clueless about what you're doing. The fear is the fear that you don't know if you will live the next day, and you don't have any decisions that can change it mm-hmm. to take.
Your role in Beirut, as you reconstruct it and reconnect with it in this whole story, is, as Israel controls the Lebanese capital, Israel's allies, the Falangist Lebanese Christians, take out revenge on Palestinian refugee camps. The killers are Lebanese. The victims are Palestinian. You and other Israelis are, in your case, launching flares to illuminate the area, in effect to assist the Falangists in doing this deed.
Yes.
Had you remembered that all those years, or did it take a lot of work to come back to that memory?
I think for us, what happened during the massacre in the camp was something that was taken out of our systems because we were not eyewitnessing it. So I think we did ourselves an easy life by saying, okay, we didn't know that it was going on.
Yeah.
The responsibility was much more a government issue. And us as common soldiers, we were clueless about what was going on. And I think the film, it deals with a lot of things, mainly about memory, but also it deals with the chronology of the massacre events, trying to figure out when do you realize that everything you hear or see or somebody else saw and told you, second and third hand information, when do you put everything into one frame and you say, okay, there is something very bad, there is mass murder going on just around the hill. And then what do you do in order to prevent it? And it's more about chronology of the events than about anything else.
Was it received as well in Israel as it's been in Europe and in the United States?
It was received too well.
Mm-hmm. Too well?
Too well, yeah.
Why? How is that?
Because I was expecting at least a kind of debate, you know? At least...
You wanted someone to say, it's a slander, this is treachery that he's engaged in.
A controversy, yeah. Something, and...
He's undermining national morale.
And then I was hugged dearly by all the political spectrum. The government took it as a project, and they keep sending the film all over the world on their expense. And I considered myself this kind of really cool rebel, and now I mean that I'm the government's darling, so it's kind of problematic for me, you know what I mean?
Well, do you think the film represents any strengths of Israeli cinema beyond the film
yes,
itself?
I mean, it is it representative of something? It represents the most important things, yeah. And that's it shows Israel as a very tolerant country. I mean, we don't have private investments in film. This film was heavily supported by a couple of Israeli film funds. And it shows all over the world that in Israel, you can say whatever you like, basically, and the government pays for that. Mm-hmm. And another thing that they realized is that, I mean, here in America, let's face it honestly, most of the people don't know anything about what happened in Lebanon. Mm-hmm. 25 years ago.
That's right.
Not that I think that it matters. I think they have to run and see the film anyhow. But
right.
In Europe, they do know. And a lot of them, for the first time in France and in England and in Germany, where it was very well received, understood that it was not Israeli troops who literally pulled the trigger in the camps and did the massacre. And that's a
problem. But it was the phalangist militia.
It was the Christian militia. And the government understood that this propaganda can't be bought with money.
So you wish that you'd been received as more of a rebel, more of a troublemaker.
Well, I'll save that for the next time. I kind of enjoy it, mm-hmm. You know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just in a way. I'm sorry that my father doesn't live to see it, because when I started the project, he was alive, and he warned me so much. You know, don't do it. Everybody will freak out, will be furious at you. You'll be haunted by the government for years. And look at me.
You're a hero.
I'm the Israeli delegation now. Wherever I go, the government, the ambassador is waiting for me, you know, welcoming me. I go to all those embassies. They have receptions for me. I mean...
Ari Folman, thanks. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks.
Ari Folman's animated documentary Waltz with Bashir opened in New York and Los Angeles yesterday.
Actor Frank Langella spent nearly 2 years of his life as Richard M. Nixon, on stage in the play Frost Nixon and now in the movie. Frost Nixon tells how in 1977, British TV personality David Frost landed the interview of a lifetime with the disgraced former president. The movie plays out as a verbal duel that one character calls the trial Richard Nixon never had. Michael Sheen plays Frost to Langella's Nixon.
Are you really saying that in certain situations, the president can decide whether it's in the best interests of the nation and then do something illegal?
I'm saying that when the president does it, that means it's not illegal.
His Nixon has already earned Frank Langella a Golden Globe nomination and talk of an Oscar. He joined us recently from New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
So many of us feel like we know Richard Nixon, or think we know Richard Nixon, something of a caricature. You certainly don't really look like him. So how did you begin to inhabit this man?
Well, obviously I couldn't have played Richard Nixon if I was 5'2" and cute and adorable. I had to be big and hulking, sort of the way he was. But once all of those obvious things were, the tests of those were passed, I did with him what I do with any character I play, which is where is his soul and what is his soul? And when you approach a part that way, it entails becoming him, really, truly, simply becoming him, so that you think, move, breathe, and act the way you feel a man in this situation would. That informs a great deal of what happened to me physically. My body began to slump, my voice began to get lower. There was a certain way in which my voice began to pitch. There was a way I looked at people, watched them, the way in which I wore glasses, held onto them, the shuffle that I noticed that he had. And in a way, it's a very difficult thing to describe because as an actor, you're not always consciously aware of things that are happening to you. They're just happening to you. You have to not be afraid when you're an actor to just be floating around in a kind of an embryonic fluid of creativity, let's call it that, and hope that when you get born, something resembling the proper human being comes out.
There's something I've read. I gather it isn't your natural way to stay in character, but that in this case you did to a degree stay in character on the set. Mm. I read that sometimes the crew would address you as Mr. President.
Oh, not sometimes. Absolutely, 100% of the time. There are, I would think, the majority of people who worked on this film never met Frank Langella. They only met Richard Nixon. I like to clown around with the crew. I really enjoy it, and there's long waits on film sets. And, you know, sometimes I'll start a card game or play Scrabble with somebody or backgammon, and I couldn't do it with Nixon. I felt that if I wasn't presidential in their minds, it would take a little of the shine off of the relationship. So I would longingly look sometimes through the distance of the set and see actors I really like and enjoy the company of, like Kevin Bacon and Sam Rockwell and Oliver Platt, who are funny guys having a great time over a cheeseburger or a donut, and I couldn't join them. I just couldn't.
It actually sounds a bit sad.
It was lonely, and it was lonely in exactly the way I needed to be lonely. So for 31 days, the cinematographer called me Mr. President. All the actors did. I can't think of another role I would play where that dynamic would be as important as it was, but it was a very smart thing to do because the soul of Richard Nixon was the soul of a man terribly isolated, really unable to communicate with other people.
I'd like to play a brief scene for our listeners at Nixon's villa by the sea in California. It's actually a place that he's in as sort of exile. The isolation here is really on display. He's talking to David Frost, who is ebullient and a partygoer.
Do you know those parties of yours? The ones that I read about in all the papers. Do you actually enjoy those?
Of course.
You got no idea how fortunate that makes you. Liking people, being liked, having that facility, that lightness, that charm. I don't have it. I never did.
There are a lot of people like this who are not terribly at ease in the company of men, and even in Nixon's case, not even at ease in the company of animals. You know, as is, there's a little scene in the movie where he pets a dog, and he's not even able to embrace that dog with real, genuine affection and love. It's sort of a distant embrace.
Mm. Yes, he seems to get almost close to touching it, and it kind of pulls back a little bit.
Yeah, it's not easy for him.
There are people to this day, and actually plenty of them, who think of Nixon as pure evil.
Mm.
That is not the Nixon that you embody.
No. You look at all the events of a life, and you look and think, this homely, shy, impossibly awkward young man. He grew up in a tiny house, which I spent a good deal of time in alone, in a small room with three boys, two of whom died, with a father who was not particularly loving or encouraging to him. I find those things very compelling. I find the ooze out of which we grow either does or doesn't come back up later in life and reclaim us. And in this instance, I think it did reclaim him.
So that's what you have to say to anyone who might say you didn't make him bad enough.
Yeah, I've heard enough of those things. He's too sympathetic, but sympathetic was never in my mind, not for a minute. It didn't even occur to me to say, oh, this might make people like him more. I think if there's a word I could use, it would be a sort of fair compassion, trying when he was in fact competitive and hostile and calculating and cruel to allow that to happen, And when he was distant and confused and isolated and lonely, allowing that to show. None of us is one thing. None of us.
Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. I've been told by someone who knows Tom Cruise and likes him very much that Mr. Cruise is so utterly professional, an actor who knows his lines, shows up on time, and greets the crew by name, that it can be a disappointing interview because he's always on message. Well, his new film, Valkyrie, has a pretty powerful message from history. It's the story of Colonel Klaus von Stauffenberg, who was at the center of the plot of German generals who tried to assassinate Adolf Hitler and take over the government to surrender to the Allies.
The army swore an oath, and an oath that won't just die with Hitler.
It doesn't matter.
It only matters that we act
now,
before we lose the war. Otherwise, this will always be Hitler's Germany. And we have to show the world that not all of us were like him. That is not enough for me. There has to be a chance of success. Then find a way.
Tom Cruise plays Stauffenberg, the man who brought a bomb in a briefcase to a meeting with the Führer. All the other German generals have British accents and are played by Kenneth Branagh, Bill Nighy, and Terrence Stamp. We sat down with Tom Cruise and the film's director, Brian Singer, in New York.
When I read a script, I'm looking at it just like an audience watching a film, and I found the story to be very uniquely told, this conspiracy suspense thriller. And I found it to be very entertaining, and also a story that I hadn't heard. Stauffenberg himself, someone who as early as 1938 is on record saying someone's got to shoot that bastard. You know, I knew pieces of it, you know, the bomb under the table. Mm-hmm. But then when in reading the script, I thought I knew where it was going to go and what was going to happen, and I found it utterly compelling.
Well, Mr. Singer, we know the ending. Okay, how do you convey suspense in a film where everybody knows that Hitler doesn't get assassinated?
Well, we have two things going. I mean, first of all, for most people, they don't quite know the ending of this particular story, of this attempt, and they don't know the fact that it was much more than just an attempt on Hitler's life. There was an actual attempt to take over the entire Nazi government, and a lot of it went into play, and a lot of it was temporarily successful.
In fact, American audiences might cheer for German soldiers as they storm military headquarters and take it over, temporarily, for the plotters. When Valkyrie was being shot last year, several German legislators were reportedly distressed that Mr. Cruise had been cast in the film. Klaus von Stauffenberg is one of the few genuine German heroes of World War II. Tom Cruise is quite famously a Scientologist, and the German government has labeled Scientology a confidence scheme. We began to ask Mr. Cruise about those complaints. He interrupted.
The stories that appeared that German authorities weren't eager to...
Yeah, but you know what? And that's not true.
There's a lot of misinterpretation.
Yeah. Misinterpretation and really, even those comments within the country and the government were only from extremists. That was just, a very...
That they didn't want you to play this role.
Yeah, it's not true.
Well, I think what happened, I think initially there might have been a knee-jerk reaction because this story is very special to Germany and to their history and to a very, very dark and terrifying history during the Second World War. So there might have been a knee-jerk reaction thinking, oh, the director of X-Men and Superman Returns and the star of Mission Impossible are coming here to make some kind of action film out of it and distort the history. And to us, we knew that the actual honest
to goodness...
And the
guy who danced in his underwear in Risky Business.
Well, you can't... I mean, no one... You know, I mean, we'd be lucky to have a scene like that. No, but But very early on, we had tremendous support from the Resistance Museum. We were given access to all their materials, documents. We had meetings with historians, people who were there at the time. I mean,
every location we needed and asked for.
Including Bendler Block, the German military headquarters where Klaus von Stauffenberg and three other plotters were shot to death by a firing squad when their coup failed. A plaque now rests in the building courtyard inscribed with their names below the line, "Here died for Germany." Before filming the scene of that execution, Tom Cruise and Brian Singer spoke to the actors and crew.
It's a very powerful moment. It's sacred ground for them, and definitely for us when we, you know, these men and women who were diametrically opposed to the Nazis and National Socialism and Hitler. So we did take a moment.
Tom spoke quite eloquently, and I asked for a moment of silence. You know, all these places where people died, this one where there's a monument, but probably the only monument to a German or in Germans who served during the Second World War, because the rest of that history is so shameful and so hard for Germans to recognize. So for us to be filming in the very spot where that happened, that's the least we could do. And hopefully make the best film we could.
I've had a lot of people want to talk about this movie, fascinated by the subject matter. And I'm talking about on the street. And you can always get a vibe on the
people
street.
People can come up to you on the street?
What?
Well, I'm just asking. I mean,
no, oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
He's a much more social. Tom's a much more accessible guy than you'd think. I mean, there are hundreds of people at a time, but they come up.
They come up. And, you know, there's been a real interest and excitement and a fascination with this subject matter. And as an American, I've had and was raised to have the ability to think for myself and have my own opinions, my own ideas. That's why even when the film opens with this oath, which I find just terrifying and bizarre, where Hitler had the army swear to God that they would follow him to the death. And it took me a while to wrap my wits around that. And every time we read it, I remember we read it, it was chilling.
This is an army with tradition, with honor. You know, in spite of what the deeds they were capable of, this was the inner conflict. And a lot of, you know, and Hitler was at a constant war with his army in a strange way. And these conspirators represented the group that went against the tide.
Every time an audience sees it, I really enjoy hearing the reactions that we've
had, been very exciting.
Conversations, the dialogue that this creates is fascinating.
Gentlemen, thanks so much for
Thank you
time.
Very much. Hey,
Tom
Merry Christmas.
And Merry
and
Christmas.
Happy holidays.
Have a happy holiday. See you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
The film Valkyrie opens nationwide on Thursday, Christmas Day. You can see movie clips and hear our entire interview with Tom Cruise and Brian Singer at our website, npr.org. And you can read my blog about our interview at npr.org/soapbox.
For more about these and other movies, visit our website at npr.org/movies.